Previously on Electric Boogaloo.
The direwolves in this episode are to the Starks as the news is to Huey Lewis.
Hmm.
I think that Huey Lewis needs the news more than the news needs Huey Lewis.
This is Game of Thrones 2, Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This is the podcast where we are obligated by law to say the word trope 19 times an episode. This week, I will have on a familiar voice, Aaron, Boss Mang Aaron. Aaron, my co-author, twice over. Aaron, founder of Bald Move. We'll hear from him on Chapter 9, that's Tyrion's first POV chapter. Also, we will check in with Steve, who has watched the final two episodes of season one. Ned's dead, baby. Ned's dead. I want to take a moment and thank the listeners of this podcast. This was an experimental 10-week season, and I realized that this was off the beaten path for the Bald Move community. And the numbers suggest that you're listening. The numbers are good. The numbers are good for this podcast. So we are considering possibly extending this Electric Boogaloo experiment beyond Chapter 9. If you could, if you've enjoyed any of this, please rate and review wherever you do such things. Share a link. Share a link on social media. Send an email attachment to a friend. Transcribe this podcast. Type it up, roll it up, put it in a bottle, throw it into the ocean. We'd love to get our numbers a little bit higher so we can get some regular ad partners. That would be fantastic. What I can say is that Steve and I will be doing a bonus podcast next week. We'll be answering a few listener emails. You can send feedback to book@baldmove.com. Without further ado, here is Boatswain Aaron Hubbard. Aaron, welcome back to your own podcast.
Yeah, man. You got the band back together again.
Yeah.
the dynamic duo, the Gods of Thrones boys. We're ready to burn the Septs down, profaning the sacred.
One last heist. You know, then we can go into retirement.
Yeah.
All right. So, Aaron, what is your relationship to your own voice?
You know, that's a good question, because I used to share a revulsion of hearing myself recorded. And like, you know, if you ever you hear it on answering machines or whatever,
yeah, as do most people.
And it was cringy as fuck to hear that. But then I noticed something, and I don't know exactly when I lost it, but somewhere over the last few years, what I sound like inside my head and outside my head have merged, because I've heard myself so much on podcasts and videos and editing them that like there's no gap. There's no, it's like if I walked around naked all day, it's like, yep, this is what my body looks like. I feel like I'm vocally naked. I'm just aware of all my flaws.
Yeah.
Well, and I've embraced
them. Yeah. This is an interesting question of human perception, because you've probably trained yourself to hear yourself differently than most people do, because you're listening to recordings of yourself so often.
Mm-hmm. And usually the critical ear, like, what am I doing wrong here? Yeah. How many times am I going to say, in a 30-second span of time? That kind of stuff. But I hear that like that gap is because, you know, the acoustics inside your head are way different than the acoustics outside. So you actually have a real difference in the perception of your voice inside versus outside your head. But I guess if you listen to it enough, it kind of, your brain normalizes it. I mean,
yeah, absolutely. It normalizes it. And this is sort of a feature of human perception. Whereas like, you've done a bit of sailing, right?
Sure.
A good friend of mine is a longtime sailor, and he can see wind before he feels it, because he's trained his eyes to notice what's happening on the waves. There's lots of cultures who have like several more colors than we do. And so you can actually train your perception to pick up things that you previously couldn't. And my guess is that you've trained your perception to hear yourself differently
than how you did before.
See, I always thought it was more of like the saturation theory. Like if you grew up on a pig farm, you don't smell pig shit. I've been living in the pig farm of my voice for the last few years, so I just don't, I don't hear how offensive it is anymore.
You've been wallowing in your own muck.
Yeah, exactly. I've saturated that aural nerve that's offended by your own voice. Yeah. Uh-huh.
All right, Aaron, what did you have for breakfast?
Oh, this is interesting because my wife sat me down and made me watch, what is that, Harley Quinn, Birds of Prey?
Sure.
She didn't make me, but I wasn't super excited to watch it, but she had seen it and said it was amazing. And she's right. That's actually a really good DC movie. It's really,
really
fun.
Huh.
Okay. But Harley Quinn eats what she describes as the most perfect breakfast sandwich, which is like an egg and bacon sandwich on ciabatta bread.
Mm-hmm.
And Cecily made us those sandwiches this morning, and it was pretty amazing. Yeah.
Well, the reason I ask, oh gosh, my breakfast was horrible. It was like egg whites and like cauliflower cakes. Horrible, horrible. But Tyrion,
the burned black bacon.
Tyrion had for breakfast. He had bread, little fish, like I don't know, sardines or something. Dark beer and blackened bacon. How does that sound to you?
That sounds like that bacon sounds like eating cancer. It's funny because I grew up thinking that is hated bacon. Yeah. But when I became an adult, I realized this was because my mom burnt bacon. Like I thought bacon was this salty bark that you endured on the side of eggs or something if you want a little bit of protein. I had no idea that you could get like thick cut bacon, that you didn't have to burn bacon. So like it's kind of like it's a little bit finding out like Tyrion likes his steak well done with ketchup.
Yeah.
Like he's just doing it wrong. There's no other, like he's such a well-read, smart, considerate guy, and he's just doing bacon wrong, in my opinion.
Yeah, he actually requests it that way. He goes out of his way to say, burn it black.
Yeah. I mean, bacon, a bit of crispy bacon, like I think that there's like, it can't be just flaccid and soggy. There has to be a little bit of a backbone and spine to
it. Oh, absolutely.
But yeah, you get the full burnt black. That's, That's eating salty charcoal, it seems like.
Okay,
so.
Now what if I served you sardines and dark beer for breakfast?
I wonder if Tyrion's done some kind of crazy reading of a mad maester that has some kind of aphrodisiac. Like, you know, this is Westeros Viagra.
Yeah,
this,
right.
This supports his other appetites because it's such a weird combo.
He was reading Archmaester Libido's long treatise on orgies, I suppose.
Yeah, the art of love as opposed to the art of war.
All right, here. I'm going to do a quick synopsis on this chapter, and then we can fill in any gaps in our conversation.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we are covering chapter 9. This is Tyrion's first point of view chapter. We meet Tyrion in the library at Winterfell. And he's been reading all night. And so he gets up and he talks to a septon to tell him to return the scrolls. He goes down. Mm-hmm. He discusses Bran's situation with Joffrey and the Hound. And it seems that this is about 4 days since Bran's fall. And then after chiding and disciplining his nephew with a couple noteworthy slaps, and a little exchange with the Hound, he goes and he meets his brother, his sister, and his nephew and his niece, who are breaking their fast. And he has a conversation about Bran with them. And that is the chapter in a nutshell. It's only 6 pages. But I think it's doing a lot of heavy lifting for that short of space. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I was actually shocked at how short it was, too, when I got, because, like, you know, I decided to sit down and read all the chapters leading up to this and do my due diligence, and it'd been a long time since I read, and I really got into it. Like, by the time I was getting to the Tyrion's chapter, I was like, man, if I wasn't rereading the Dune series. But I was having a lot of fun. I get this Tyrion chapter. I'm like, all right, this is the assignment. And then it was like a roller coaster ride. It was over before it felt like it began. But
yeah,
I was just struck when I was reading these early chapters of seeing like how Martin was still kind of rounding in his gardener way himself into some of these characters. Like, what shameless, unrepentant flounces both Jon Snow and Arya are. Like, yes. Like prone yeah. to tears burning with rage, red-faced, shameful, storming out of rooms and great halls because yeah. they're embarrassed, and how, like, that doesn't stick around very long. And you know, in Chapter 5, you have Tyrion, you know, George Martin playing around with, you know what, maybe I'm going to have him be a tumbler. That'll be cute. Have the little
yeah,
guy
right.
have a tumble routine. And he mentioned that's being one of his few regrets of his early characterizations. But just, like, he's hitting all the notes. Like, why he wants us clearly to love Tyrion, so he paints him as very smart. He paints him as kind of cool and detached from the family that he started, you know, the Martin's already 10 chapters in painting as kind of dastardly, or I guess 9 chapters.
Yeah.
10 with the prologue. And, you know, he's funny. He's this one down position. Like, he talked in the previous chapter to Jon Snow that, you know, all bastards or all dwarfs are bastards. Yet he has the temerity to slap the crown prince. Something yes. that even a very dangerous character seems to think is dangerous. And he's got this devil may care attitude towards his family. And you wonder how much of his family's secrets does he know? Because we've got introduced to some of his family's secrets in the previous
That's
chapter.
Right.
It's a lot. Like you said, it's a lot in 6 pages.
Yeah. Okay. So two things. You said something that I hadn't thought of before, but really makes a lot of sense. So we're meeting these characters for the very first time in these first few chapters. But in a way, Martin's meeting them for the first time. If ever you've tried your hand at writing fiction, you know, these characters are not usually not fully formed in your head. You kind of meet them. You discover them as you're writing them. And so these first meetings are really Martin giving a go, like trying something on for size. Tyrion's a tumbler. Maybe not. Maybe not. Maybe he's.
Yeah.
Maybe in the next time I introduce him, he'll be, you know, massaging his legs because they really don't work very well. And one of his shoulders is rounded in a twisted way because of his entire body's twisted. It almost looks like he has gotten rid of the this able-bodied Tyrion that we've met just a couple chapters ago. He's already. Discovered something that's more interesting about Tyrion that he wants to play up a little bit differently. Yeah.
The other thing is he does this kind of like, you know, anytime you want to establish, like on Star Trek The Next Generation, anytime you want to establish a character as a badass, you just have him kick Worf's ass. And Worf is the toughest guy in the Enterprise. And this guy just threw Worf through a bulkhead. Oh my God, he's amazing. And like they do a little bit of this with Tyrion where like Tyrion has outstudied a Septon. You know, like this stuffy cleric who spends his time probably cloistered. Like, especially, what does a Septon have to do at Winterfell? He just spends his time cloistered reading books. And and Tyrion reads him into the dirt. He's like, you know, Tyrion's gone all night long, gone through candles, gone through mugs of ale, and this guy passed out over his history, like, in the wee hours of the morning. It's a little bit like showing that Tyrion is a more serious student than the serious professional student class of Westeros.
Yeah, not only that, but he notices what the Septon's reading. Like, the Septon's, like, passed out on his book. He notices what the Septon's reading, and he's like, typical. Of course, the Septon would be reading that idiot.
Yeah. And it's, him instructing the Winterfell librarian and how to better look after his stock. It's pretty good. Pretty good introduction this guy as a scholarly person.
All right. So, Aaron, this is the guest choice portion of the podcast wherein you can choose to talk about a character, a theme, a plot point, or we can just climb the ladder of chaos together.
I mean, I think we would be sued for podcasting malpractice if we didn't talk about the character Tyrion in his first named chapter, right?
Yeah, exactly.
What do you say about Tyrion? I'm gonna make a couple statements to see what sticks.
Okay.
Is Tyrion a Gary Stu? Gary Stu, if you don't know, is a literary term. Most common you hear it says a Mary Sue, where an author self-inserts themselves into the material and give them all the awesome qualities, and maybe they have a couple of apparently negative qualities that are actually pluses. Like, you know, you look at Bella from Twilight, you know, and she's a misfit outcast teenager with super pale, sallow skin, but she also is chased after by the most beautiful boy in school, and et cetera, et cetera. A lot of people say that, like, Sam Tarly is the Gary Stu. That's the George R. R. Martin. But, like, is it secretly Tyrion?
Well, I think that with a Mary Sue character, in addition to having some of the notable qualities of the author, this character also has to sort of achieve some fantasy that the authors are always had. So let's say George Martin has always sort of, you know, lamented his own body, but he's always felt like he's pretty quick-witted, and this all fits Tyrion. But what's the one thing that Tyrion can do that George Martin's always wanted to do that can only be fulfilled by a fictional character? I think that
have sex with multiple women at a time while he's quaffing beer.
So Tyrion's really good at that. And so maybe George Martin can live out his weird, perverted fantasies through Tyrion. And in which case, I think that many characters in this narrative may be Mary Sue's for
That's
Martin's
true. That's
perverted,
true.
perverted ideation.
It's funny because Tyrion is like this character who had not the I always thought like I think it's interesting to think about what would happen to these people if the events of the book didn't happen, you know, like what if the days of Robert Baratheon are allowed to, you know, run out peacefully. And I think of like, you know, Tyrion would be such a boring character. Because he would continue to kind of just go about Westeros, do whatever he wants, read a bunch of books, frequent a bunch of sex workers, and probably drink himself into an early grave. But because that he finds himself kind of plunged into the middle of this murder mystery, that is the kind of like match that sets off the powder keg that is the post-rebellion Westeros Seven Kingdoms, he gets to be this dynamic figure of destiny, and it's super frustrating to talk about because we ultimately don't know where that ends for him.
It's funny you say that because I feel like I look back at these early Tyrion years with nostalgia, like, oh, wasn't he fun when he was just sort of like saying screw you to everyone he meets, and he kind of understands everyone's motives better than they understand them themselves, and he's just drinking and he's just a hedonist. And when he becomes Hand of the King and when he becomes a prisoner and then exile, it's almost like, oh, I kind of wish we could have fun Tyrion again. But what you're saying that makes a lot of sense is that Tyrion couldn't have existed for very long and remained interesting. We really need to see him go into the pit and try to think his way out of the pit in order for him to really get interesting, right? The other thing about this chapter that I found really interesting is that Tyrion, well, first of all, this isn't just the first POV chapter from a Lannister. This is the first POV chapter of anyone who resides in King's Landing. So we are being introduced to people like the Hound and Joffrey and Cersei and Jaime and Myrcella, all through Tyrion's point of view, and in a very short amount of pages, Tyrion has a much different interaction with all of these characters. And so what we see here is we're seeing the politics of King's Landing for the first time through the eyes of someone who knows that world pretty well. And I'm thinking specifically of the Joffrey interaction. And it's almost like Tyrion knows very well that anything he does to slight Joffrey's, it may come back on him eventually. In fact, the Hound says, look, he's going to remember that. So I don't know if that shows lack of foresight or whether he just thinks I'll deal with that when the time comes. But that's an interesting dynamic that's going to have major consequences later on.
That's the funny thing. It's like for a gardener, he really gardened himself in some good situations because this, you know, like his nephew will remember that is going to pay off handsomely in the next novels where his nephew is going to be elevated to boy king.
Yeah.
And Tyrion's going to have this like, well, I have the cloak of my father's ultimate authority protecting me. But, you know, you can feel his kind of frustration and fear with, like, you know, working with this material that he's got and, like, you know, what do we do about this guy? But, like, you know, all these things that he did kind of cavalierly thinking that he would be, maybe a decade, maybe multiple decades away. Maybe he'd be dead and, like I said, drunk himself into a grave before he has to deal with all this stuff. And in the meantime, fuck it. Because ultimately... I struck reading this when you look at kind of the, you know, Jaime's deadly. His father always travels with an honor guard. Joffrey has the Hound as a sworn shield. I'm kind of amazed that Tyrion doesn't have some form of protection. Like, the Bronn relationship works so well, and it's another thing that feels like Martin kind of gardened himself into. Tyrion feels kind of naked without...
Yeah.
You know, someone to back up his swagger and bluster. You got to wonder, like, when he's been wandering the Seven Kingdoms and kind of reading books and doing, like, and insulting people and having this barbed tongue, like, why hasn't a commoner, like, put an end to this guy? What's protected him?
Yeah, his interaction with the Hound is really interesting because there's a decided class distinction between these two. The Hound is towering over him. The Hound, he's just this muscled, burnt-faced brute with this raspy voice who could end Tyrion at any moment. And Tyrion, he just knows, look, I'm of higher rank socially, politically. He just knows he's of higher rank, and so that's his armor. He just trusts that everyone's going to abide by these social cues. And he's basically at the top of this pecking order, and he uses that like armor, and that can get you pretty far in the Seven Kingdoms, it seems, as long as you're traveling with people that adhere to the social cues and can be swayed by money and can be outwitted. You know, Tyrion can get pretty far, you know, with just his brains and his purse.
Right. And then I get what you're saying, because, like, did you watch The New Pope?
No.
Okay. So The New Pope, John Malkovich plays the titular New Pope, and he comes from England, which is unusual for a Pope. And he's in the upper class. Like, he's a member of, he's royalty. He's got blue blood. He's fabulously wealthy. And at one point, one of those underlings are trying to blackmail him with a scandal because he's also a heroin addict. Mild spoilers for the new Pope. And he says, he says something like, you know, scandals are the concern of the petite bourgeoisie. I was taught that form polished to perfection equals like this unassailable regal armor that, you know, the lesser people can't really touch. And if you just carry yourself as better than everyone and you can fool your lessers into thinking that that's some kind of ironclad law, then it is something like armor that you can wear. But, like, you just think about, like, you know, what if he runs into, like, Biter? you know,
right.
What if he runs into someone who's got his teeth filed down and he's just, you know, one bad day away from being, you know, beheaded or sent to the black and he's got nothing to lose? Like, how has he not ran into somebody like that in his, you know, what, right. Is he 30? No, he's not quite 30 in this, is he? He's in his 20s.
I get the sense that he is. Okay, so this is interesting because we know that Ned and Jaime both fought in Robert's Rebellion, right?
Right.
So they were, and we know that Ned is supposed to be in his, around his 30, you know, mid to late 30s.
Yeah, he's got gray in his beard, which makes him look older than his mid-30s that he is. But yeah.
So my guess is that Tyrion has to be younger than 30. That would be my guess.
Yeah.
Jaime's the older brother. Yeah, that's just my guess at this point. And yet, here he is. He's been walking around, let's say, for 20 years as a really good poker player, but perpetually without any face cards. It's like he can sit down at the table, and he doesn't have any tells, and he can bluff his way pretty well. You know, he knows how to read the other characters at the table. But eventually, someone's going to figure out that you've never played a face card. And I don't know how long you can live a charmed life in that fashion.
Well, so. It's a good thing he finds Bronn later on, because he might have gotten to a situation there at the Eyrie where he had played his last card until Bronn decided, why not? I like the size of that purse. You know, you mentioned something interesting about like the fact that this is the first time we get an internal POV of the Lannister or like any of these people from the court. And, you know, Martin has already set up like the people from King's Landing to be these untrusty kind of untrustworthy, non-serious hedonists compared to like the somber and serious and honorable Starks.
Yeah.
And it's so rare that when you flip the camera, like think about in Star Wars when, you know, we met the rebels and we've met the Empire and then we finally get an interior of the we go to Grand Moff Tarkin's boardroom and he's having an evil boardroom meeting and no one there is like anti the Empire's agenda, right? There's like some people being like, let's do evil, and the other people's like, well, we got to be careful about doing evil because we do evil too often too fast and we're just going to get, and the other guy's like, well, it doesn't matter because we got the big evil beach ball,
right.
But no one's like he's having debate like, you know, actually the rebels have a point, you know. Or and when we get to this, we flip the POV over to the quote unquote bad guys. Our first character is full of that, hinting that he knows his family's dangerous secrets, that he might not be entirely on their side, that there is some intrigue here, that there are some, this is not entirely a house undivided. And it, interestingly, like Game of Thrones instantly becomes more interesting because of it. It's just like, again, like if you go back to The Lord of the Rings, you never go to like, you know, Saruman and he's having private regrets and reflections about how he betrayed Gandalf. It's all just power and for the One Ring and for the Tower of Barad-dûr. And, you know, it's like there's already these multifaceted sides, which is why everyone fell in love with Martin. Why we wish he'd start writing again.
Yeah, exactly. Let me read this little passage here. This is about Jaime. So he says, he has a large heart, our Robert, Jaime said with a lazy smile. There was very little that Jaime took seriously. Tyrion knew that about his brother and forgave it. During all the terrible long years of his childhood, only Jaime had ever shown him the smallest measure of affection or respect. And for that, Tyrion was willing to forgive him almost anything. And just in that little space, here's this character that just a few pages ago pushed a kid out the window.
Mm-hmm.
So Jaime Lannister is the villain of the story at this point. And yet now we've learned that this character, Tyrion, had a very hard childhood. He's a disappointment to his father, that his sister has always sort of loathed him. And yet his brother has always shown him kindness and respect. Or not always, but he's the one guy. And so much so that Tyrion is willing to forgive him almost anything. And so right away, Jaime is this complex character who can act with virtue as a villain or can act in ignoble ways as a hero. And we're not, at this point, I think he's a villain who can be nice sometimes, but I think that gets swapped eventually.
Yeah, it's amazing how quickly Martin kind of like sketches that, like in a few sentences with his interaction with John in the previous chapter, you find out that, you know, his dad hates him because he's a dwarf, and moreover also because he killed his mother in childbirth, and everyone kind of, and you see that, you know, with right before that passage you just read, you hear when Cersei sees him, his sister peer to him with the same expression of faint distaste she had worn since the day he was born.
That's right.
So quickly sketching out the family dynamics, and then you hit with the quote that you read, and man, the almost or the most anything there is doing a lot of work, because he's really creating this cognitive dissonance in the mind of the reader. Like, man, we really like this Tyrion guy and hate that friggin' Jaime. God, threw a child out the window, but he's the only person that loved Tyrion. Oh my God, what does that say about me? What does that say about Jaime? What does that say about Tyrion? It's just such an effective and quick sketch of these family dynamics that you've got him down cold. And he spent maybe 6 or 7 sentences total describing them. And everything else is going to play out from this.
Exactly. And we know, so Tyrion's kind of playing the room. He says something along the lines of, yeah, I think the boy, the Stark boy might live. And he notices this glance that Cersei and Jaime share. And Martin doesn't say much about it, but we get the sense that Tyrion knows these people. He knows them pretty well. And he has a sense that they had something to do with the fact that Bran fell out the window. So when he says he's willing to forgive him most anything, it's almost to say, yeah, this is my brother. I love him. And moreover, he was my only friend as a child. And even if he's in love with his twin sister, even if he pushed a kid out the window, my love is not going to waver.
See, I think that what Martin's doing with that forgive him most anything is introduce some doubt into our mind as a reader of like where that line of forgiveness would, you know, like he does it. It's not unqualified. So we're like, I wonder if he knew the truth about Bran, if he would turn against him. Now, it turns out probably not. Like Tyrion loves Jaime almost limitlessly.
Yeah.
And his rejection of him eventually is going to be something that haunts him in the books to come. But I do think that Martin's pretty smart of keeping that card pretty close to his vest so that the audience can form their own opinions and get a little bit, you know, we're going to fall even deeper in love with Tyrion as this book goes ahead. And we're going to think Jaime's even bigger and bigger shit as things go on. And there's even something interesting here about, like, because this is the first, I think, introduction for the rest of the royal family, like Marcella and Tommen. And I think it's interesting that he described, like, you know, Tommen's very sweet, says, I don't want Brandon to die. And this is on the back of, you know, Ned's musings that I need to bring Bran to court because, you know, he's sweet natured and he likes everybody. And Rob and Joffrey have bad blood. And, you know, decades from now, that could be bad. So let's have some best friends in the mix. And,
yeah, right.
You know, just as an aside, it's like you imagine a world in which Bran had gone to court and him and Tommen were best buddies. And, you know.
Right.
But he says something about, like, he's a sweet boy, not like his brother, which, you know, we're still trying to figure out how we feel about Joffrey at this stage. But then it says, but then Jaime and Tyrion were somewhat less than like peas in a pod themselves. And early on, you think about like how that is limited to their physical appearances. You know, Jaime's this paragon of beauty and manly strength and martial prowess. And, you know, Tyrion is the opposite of that. But it's funny that in the morality game, they kind of like pass that pee back and forth between each other. Like they both do pretty despicable and reprehensible things. You know,
Jaime's.
Yeah. So it's like,
in fact, you know, Tyrion, we often want to forget this about Tyrion, but he falls in love with this sex worker and he eventually murders her. This is Tyrion, who we all know and love.
Chokes her to death in a murderous rage. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, exactly. But we learn that about Tyrion pretty late into his narrative arc.
Right.
First thing we learn about Jaime is that he's a child killer. And then we have to kind of re-educate ourselves along the way about, oh, actually, he's more complex than that.
But it's interesting that that arc happens in reverse with Tyrion, where we like him immediately. We think he's amazing. And then we're kind of maybe shocked at what he ends up doing. And, you know, it's not just like he goes through a pretty cruel phase where he's very cruel to Penny, the dwarf companion that he's forced to be with, and this troop of slaves. He kind of turns into like a real Jaime Lannister-esque shit. But like Jaime in the same part in the book is well on to his way of redemption. Like he's on his tour of Westeros and we're starting to change our opinion of him and all that kind of stuff. We're rooting for him to get his sword arm back, where Tyrion is wallowing in the mud in the later books of Song of Ice and Fire. So
yeah, this is Tyrion's where do whores go face.
Yeah, it's weird. It's like, is it impossible for both brothers to share the light at the same time? Like if one of them comes the light, the other has to go to darkness. What kind of yin and yang is Martin playing with here?
Okay, notable introductions. All right, so there are some really superficial introductions, like for instance, Winterfell has a library. But the notable introduction that I noticed in this chapter is that we have this first hint that Bran is in this coma, but that he tends to do better if his wolf is by his side.
Yeah.
So they try to shut the wolf out of the room and his heartbeat slows and he starts to you know, languish. And the wolf wants to get in the room, and finally they let the wolf back in the room, and then he starts doing better. And I wonder if this is just the first introduction of this sort of warg psychic connection between Bran and his animal.
Yeah, there's, but it's fascinating to see the hints of it for sure.
And Tyrion actually says, I think the wolf is keeping him alive. Maybe like speaking with more knowledge than he really has. And we know that Tyrion is a kind of a cynic when it comes to these things, but it's almost like he's dropping that little clue for us.
Right.
That there's a connection between these that's more than just sort of your usual owner pet relationship.
Yeah, and it's easy to excuse it, interpret it multiple ways, right? Because he could just be saying, well, he's a Stark and their sigil is the direwolf. It's like that animistic kind of like, you know, totem kind of relationship.
Right.
But he's also accidentally just saying the literal, you know, quote unquote scientific truth here, that there is a symbiotic relationship and they do draw strength from each other and they share a very real spirit, mystical, you know, green seer type connection here.
Well, there's a lot of God talk between the Lannisters in the way that they are, you know, sharing playful banter. Like he tells Joffrey, you know, you should go visit them and tell them that your prayers go with them. And then Cersei says these northern gods are really cruel. And it's almost like the Lannisters are speaking this language that everyone else is speaking, but they also know that there's a subtext there. So we're not sure whether Tyrion is actually speaking his true sense of this warg connection, or whether he's just sort of speaking with the parlance of his day, and that parlance kind of includes this superstition from time to time.
Well, especially compare and contrast it to like Joffrey, who his main sin in this particular chapter is that he hasn't got that distinction yet. Like, I don't give a shit. I don't believe any of this stuff. I don't think it matters. And like Tyrion's like, yeah, but you got to do it for the sake of the form, you know, whereas the Lannisters are all speaking about God and the gods and this and that and playing lip service. But they clearly, you know. It's not the same as a Septon, you know.
That's right. In that way, Joffrey sort of learned that lesson from Robert, because Robert is sort of this one note singer as well. He doesn't care about looking good politically. He's the strongest man in the realm.
Right.
That's how he views himself, and he's proven it. And so he's going to say whatever he wants to say. He's going to sleep with whoever he wants to sleep with. He doesn't care what people think, because let them say what they're going to say. And I think that Joffrey thinks, yeah, that's what it looks like to be a king. I'm the most powerful, and so I'm just going to say what I want to say. Tyrion, people like Tyrion and Jaime have lived a little bit more. They've learned other lessons. All right, so book differences versus show differences. A lot of the dialogue between these Lannisters are pretty well represented in the show. The one thing I did note was that Tyrion's bookishness is played up a lot more with Martin than it is in the HBO adaptation. We get a lot of Tyrion's hedonism in the show.
Yes. Yes.
We get sort of a hint, a nod and a wink toward his bookishness. But not nearly as much as the other thing.
No, like, I mean, he's got the line later that he gives to John that, like, you know, a book is like a whetstone and my weapon is my mind and et cetera, et cetera. But like, it's almost like they wanted to really make an impression on us, and they made a big impression with the manner of Tyrion's, you know, he's living like he wants to die with a girl's mouth around his cock as he's drinking an improbable amount of alcohol. And then later they start adding in the nuance where, you know, he's this guy who's like very smart and brainy and all that kind of stuff. And I don't know. That's probably, I mean, I think that's, I'll actually give the Double D some credit. I think they're pretty good pretty good at adapting written material to the screen, because you want to have like these big splashy introductions and then fill it in. You know, it's kind of like an adaptation is kind of like a Bob Ross painting where like sometimes you're better off just splashing onto huge blotches of colors and then you add the shade and then you add the shapes and then you drag your knife down and shade the mountainside and it gets better. Whereas in the book, you can kind of like paint more in the details, like just hey, here's a twig and here's the leaves and mm-hmm. Oh, it's going to become a tree, because just the pacing and the way we absorb that information is different. But in a visual medium, you want to hit someone with a face and an indelible image, and they certainly did that. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, imagine the same thing entering. Yeah, I think I prefer it that way, because like I'm trying to think of like literally following him where he's getting up, you know, all this stuff happening in his head where he's judging the Septon for what he's reading and mentioning that it's all, you know, too stuffy and that's why I fell asleep. We miss all that because there's no way to communicate it. And he's tiptoeing down a staircase. It's like, yeah, they probably did the smart thing.
I was interviewing Jenna Matthews. She said something I never considered, but I think is totally true. That in the early stages of Game of Thrones, the showrunners are really trying to capture a certain demographic of male and and specifically capture the male gaze in the way that they're portraying sex on screen. And so mm-hmm. it's not just sex. It's sex that would sort of bespeak soft porn or something like that. So right. They're trying to draw a certain kind of audience member. And they're using Tyrion in this way in a few different cases. And so, mm-hmm. You know, what's going to excite people about Tyrion? Well, he's polyamorous. What's not going to excite people about Tyrion? He'll outread a Septon. You know, that's just right. Not nearly as sexy to know about Tyrion. I wanted to ask you this question because a lot of people have opinions about it. There are differences between the way the actors look versus the way that they're described in the book. And maybe Tyrion is the most significant of these. So I feel like people are pretty divided. Some people would rather the book description be portrayed on the screen, but then there are a lot of people that are pretty happy with Dinklage and maybe think he's a better character because he's as handsome as Peter Dinklage. What do you think?
I think that we are blessed that we had an actor who had made a point to not just do dwarf roles, to pass on some that go for things that were substance, to work on his craft, to do things, amazing little sketches of how it feels to be a little person in something like The Station Agent, which I don't know if you've seen, but like if you want to see fantastic. A fucking powerhouse Dinklage performance, check that out. And we had this guy who had been quietly doing all these things to make himself like the ultimate Tyrion. Yes, he is too handsome, but you got to be pretty picky if you want to go and find a little person actor who is physically deformed and, you know, has got a hunchback and walks with like, you know, like and also can act in this extraordinarily brave and human fashion. Like, I don't know, because like, the thing is like you have it's the way we relate to characters in books is more kind of like an altruistic way. We interface with them like on their intellectual and soul level. We see their inner thoughts. We can literally see their inner beauty with their eyes, because that's how we see them, through their thoughts and their, where on the screen we interface with characters the way we do in real life, which means unfortunately conventional people get the shaft.
Yeah, I think so, you know? Too. And I think I'm able to hold both images in my mind as I'm reading. I mean, I certainly see Dinklage when I'm reading Tyrion. I'll kind of switch over to this character as he is, you know, meant to be depicted in the book. So I'm almost holding these two images simultaneously. Whereas with someone like Cersei, I only see Lena Headey. That's the only thing I see when I read Cersei.
Sure. Well, and I've also thought too that like some of these are like, how sure are we that these characters are actually as disgusting as they're portrayed? Because, you know, we hear that Arya in early goings is horse-faced and long-faced and manly-faced and gaunt and gangly. And but yet we also hear that she favors her aunt, Lyanna, who is one of the most beautiful, was consensus one of the most beautiful women in the Seven Kingdoms. Right. You know, we're told that Brienne is ugly because she's mannish and she's brutish and she's got thick lips and a broad smile and beautiful golden hair and large luminous eyes. And I'm thinking, like, really? Like, this could easily be a Julia Roberts type or a Carly Simon type. But is she ugly because she's defying the conventional stereotypes? Is she a bit like, is it she's a threat in the same way that, like, it turns out Arya is probably very beautiful, but her sister's just kind of a prick and all of her ladies at waiting are picking on her. And, you know, they're doing the mean girl thing where they're tearing her down. So it's like every time I read characters that are supposedly hideous and then I see them, you know, portray, like, you know, Brienne is portrayed by the quite pretty Gwendolyn Christie, I always think it's like, well, that's where the prejudices of the time are meeting with the reality, which these people might not be that ugly at all. It's just that's what people are saying about them because they're trying to run them down. And I don't know to what extent, like, you know, they're pretty graphic and that Tyrion's hunchbacked and he's kind of twisted and he's got a fucked up gait and mismatched eyes and some stuff like that. But like, is that more of him, you know, like the rumors of him having monstrous animal features and bat wings and is that just like the most ridiculous form of that, where he's internalized those thoughts about people? And maybe he is more Peter Dinklage, conventionally handsome. It's just that people can't see him that way because he's a stunted dwarf, you know?
I've never heard anyone criticize Dinklage's British accent, but I find it wanting. I'm probably going to make a lot of enemies, but I can tell you're trying to make this accent work and it's not quite working. Has that ever occurred to you?
No, it hasn't.
Who plays Jaime? Nikolai Kostov?
Is that Koster Waldau? Yeah.
I mean I've never questioned anything about his performance. Sometimes I love Dinklage. I know he's really an important character. We all celebrate Peter Dinklage. But at times, I feel like, I really wish they would have found a British actor for this role. Just for that reason. What they've said, that in retrospect, everyone loves Dinklage. But when they were casting, he was the only person on the list. You know, he tried out for the part. They didn't try out anyone else for the part.
Well, I'll admit that maybe I'm too much of a Dinklage defender, because his voice work in Destiny as the robot ghost is almost universally reviled, and I quite enjoyed it. So maybe I just love the way the man's voice sounds. Well, he's faux British, slightly mechanical, I'll take it, whatever.
Yeah, you just want him reading fairy tales as you drift off to sleep.
Yeah, can he be my GPS navigator?
All right, we will end with this question. In all of the books, any character in all of Ice and Fire, the character that your friends and family think you are versus the character deep down inside you know you are. So it's a two-part question.
Oh, man. There's no way I can answer this without making myself seem like I'm just a giant asshole.
That's what we want, Aaron.
Okay, I'm going to balance it out. I think my friends and family probably would choose Tyrion.
Okay.
Because I am pretty, got a sharp tongue. I do like to read a lot. I do like to expound on, you know, I mean, fuck, I'm not telling tales on myself. I think I tend to be pretty, I can be a blowhard and opine about stuff. And and then to bounce it out, I'll say I deep down think I'm Moon Boy. because I don't think that highly of myself. Let me see. Who's a character that's very conflict? Who's a character? Because like I'm trying to think of the character that's very conflicted and might have a decent amount of abilities, but always second guesses and doubts themselves. Because that's who would that be?
Sansa has more ability than she knows.
Yeah, Arya she started does. Off life pretty arrogant. Yeah, Arya, does she really doubt herself? I'm thinking like maybe later books, Melisandre.
Yeah, go ahead, Melisandre. Late books,
Melisandre might be good because, like, you know, like her, I grew up very devout and fiery in my beliefs and then was proven wrong about everything. And then lately wonder like, gee whiz, what is the best use of my time? What should I be talking about? What action should I champion? I've been wrong about everything. Do I even have the right to open my mouth about anything? That's a pretty good Aeron analog.
Yeah, Mel starts out pretty certain about herself and then sort of drifts into doubt, but she doesn't doubt that she has a sort of a political role to play. That's interesting. I would have never made that connection between you and Mel.
So as a member of my friends and family, yeah. how would you identify me?
Well, I mean, I think you're kind of classic Tyrion. And so it really does work with what you were just saying. I was just wondering, like, if I wanted a podcast in the world of Westeros and I wanted two characters to start a podcast, Tyrion would definitely be one of these characters. I think Tyrion works for you. And it makes sense to me that you don't see yourself as Tyrion in that way. But, you know, you drink and know things. That's a very Aeron, you know, Aeron slogan.
Yeah, that, like, a couple birthdays back, my mother-in-law got me that t-shirt for my birthday. So it's like...
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
It works. All right, man. Well, I probably speak for 30,000 people when I say it's just really fun to hear your voice on this feed again.
Yeah.
It's a privilege.
Yeah, no, it's been a lot of fun. I really enjoyed my reread of the early goings of Game of Thrones. I guess Kindle tells me I'm like already 15% of the way through it, just at chapter 9. So... really pulling for you. I hope that people are enjoying it as much as I did. And who knows? Maybe I'll pop back up again in the future.
Well, anytime, more of you, less of me would really do wonders for this particular podcast.
We'll see. I think you got a pretty strong brand. What? Let me ask you that same question, just out of curiosity. Yeah. Who do you see yourself as? Who do you think your friends will see yourself as?
Well, I've been asked this before, and here's what I said. I think that the character that my colleagues, friends, and family would probably see me as is Varys. Because,
really?
Yeah, I think so. Because I think Varys keeps his cards very close to himself, but he's always very polite. He's politically savvy, and I think I think some people, because I can be sort of an interior creature, I think some people can be a little suspicious, like, what is he really thinking? Or, you know, can we really trust him? So Varys, I think, would be how other people would view me. Also, I don't have a whole lot of hair. And if I could, I would always walk around in flowing robes. That just seems fantastic to me.
And padded silk slippers.
The character I feel like deep down inside is Arya. And that's basically because... of just sort of being black sheep of the family, sort of being isolated from my family, geographically.
You're the black sheep of your family?
Well, I mean...
You're the blackfish of the Ladon household?
I am a little blackfish, yeah, because there are six siblings in my family, big Italian family. They all live within about an hour of each other in California. And I'm the only one.
You're the one that is.
I'm
escaped
across the narrow sea. I'm somewhere else doing something else.
Yeah.
You know. So yeah, a little bit.
You got your gold forked beard and your blue mustache and.
Yeah. Right.
your strange dress and grooming habits.
Now
yeah,
part of this is because I just love Arya. I mean, she's easily my favorite character. She's also a character that can kind of put on a different visage from time to time so she doesn't reveal what's going on in her internal world. All right, man. Mm-hmm. I think we covered some ground.
Okay. Awesome. Yeah, I think we made a meal out of the six pages.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
And now Steve and I talk about the final two episodes. Steve.
Yes, sir.
Do you lay awake at night fearing my gash?
Yeah, I was quite the back and forth, huh?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Varys.
Yeah.
I suppose you could say I'm a little bit like Varys.
Yeah.
In a few ways.
Are any of them biological?
Yes, but I'm not going to tell you which ways.
Oh, now I'm going to lie awake at night.
All right. Well, I think I'd like to open this to you. We're covering the last two episodes of season one. And I'm just going to open this to you, Steve. What do you want to talk about?
Surprising from a production perspective that the way Baelor ended, that wouldn't be
the season finale.
Season finale, right? So you were wise to want to combine these, right? At least from a my viewing perspective. But I did feel like you could have just ended right there, right?
I think it's genius. I think it's like they're saying to the audience, no, this isn't even the season finale. We've got something else in store for the season finale.
I agree with that. But there was aspects of the season finale that felt like the first episode of a new season.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And you know, again, I've grown accustomed to Who Shot JR type season finales, right? I mean,
there was some resolution there, but it was a sort of resolution that it was sort of like, well, now where do they go with this? Like, yeah, when Joffrey says, Sir Ilyn, bring me his head, Sansa faints, Cersei's losing her shit. She's screaming. Everyone but the headsman, basically, and the hound, they're pretty stoic, but everyone else is just totally losing it.
So this is a big moment, right? I mean, this is why you shouldn't let teenagers do anything and have any agency whatsoever. Because, I mean, look, let's just forget about the fact that he's hideous, but let's just go.
I was just thinking that he has had unwarranted entitlement because he's such a good-looking young man.
Yeah, that's not the case. I think we talked about this last week. The children speak as they're doing impressions of adults.
Yeah, sure.
And this is a perfect example of that, right? It's like, hey, I got to establish myself as this type of leader right now. And it does reek of a youthful naivete, but at the same time, it's like it's not outside of this type of world that a king would behave that way.
Well, that's right. And, I mean, Joffrey's a moral monster. We know that already. And yet, would you be comfortable with any teenage boy having unlimited autocracy? I mean, any kind of teenage boy with fully authoritarian power, he's going to play with it. I mean, he's going to see what the limits are. He's going to see what it feels like to behead some fool.
Yeah. I mean, he's awful. And
he's a unique creature. He's a beautiful, but dangerous beast.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like a blind salamander that you find when digging.
Interestingly enough, when Varys is talking with Ned about why he did what he did, it was something like, what madness led you to tell the queen what you had learned? And he says, the madness of mercy.
Right.
He thought that if he told Cersei that he knew that he was going to tell Robert, then she would hightail it out of King's Landing with all of her children, and maybe the children could be spared because Robert was just going to kill them all.
Right.
Because that's kind of Robert likes to do such things.
Right. And
so he was actually trying to save Joffrey's life.
Yeah.
That didn't work out so well. Arya's running away, and we meet a character. I don't know if you caught his name. He's the little fat boy that she intimidates.
Yeah. What
did you catch his name?
I don't recall.
His name is Hot Pie. Hot Pie.
That's awesome.
And he will return in season two.
Oh, good.
So I just thought if you hadn't caught that, maybe you'd like to know that his name's Hot Pie.
That's amazing.
Shag is axe.
Shag likes axes.
Shag.
Yeah, man, that was, I watched that scene twice at least. Just the it's the way it's said. I mean, Tyrion's just Dragalax axis. Just
there's a huge father-son theme. We meet Walder Frey. He's the old lecherous guy who has too many sons and he wants to marry his daughters off.
Yeah.
He's a treat. He's just a treat. So you've got him showcasing his fatherly capabilities. And you've got Rob and Ned, the Rob and Ned thing. So Rob's going to try to save his father. You've got Tywin in that episode. You have Tyrion's story of how Tywin dealt with this woman that he had married when he was a young man. And I think that whether by either metaphor or, you know, despite literal gender assignment, I think Ned and Arya kind of fit into this father-son theme as well. And what happens is, because of Ned's actions and what happens to Ned, then the question next is, what's going to happen to Arya?
Right.
What is Ned's legacy for his children? And immediately you kind of get the sense that, okay, Arya's just, she's completely unanchored. She's adrift. Her life is in danger. And immediately in the next episode, she gets grabbed by Yoren and he very helpfully reassigns her gender for her.
Right.
So I think that there's a big father-son theme here. And I think that the question we're supposed to be asking is, what have the fathers done that will either improve the prospects of their sons, or are the sons just sort of living with the consequences of the father's sins or stupidity or whatever you want to call it?
Right. Yeah, that definitely permeates, right? And that's where the complicated decision-making comes into play. And then, of course, then we've got the elimination of both father and son in the Dothraki narrative.
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. So
you have a hard reset, right? A hard reset where essentially she both kills her husband and her son. In one respect, one seemed more like, oops, I didn't realize that was the exchange. But on the other hand, I don't know.
I think that she kind of knew what she was trading. I mean, the horse thing was sort of a relief to her, but I think she was, before Miri Mazdor says, bring me his horse, I kind of feel like she's willing to trade almost anything for Drogon's life.
Right. And so that brings up a question too. And this is something that, and I found out that my wife, who had watched the first season, she only made it to she made it through the final episode, but not, she never finished the final episode. She got to the point where Joffrey said, look at your father's head. And then she had to pause it and do something. And then our subscription ran out.
So that's a good way to end the season right there.
Exactly. So that was pretty funny. So she was not super thrilled that I was like, yeah, we're going to end it right here. She's like, we can watch the next season, like right now. And I'm like, I got a podcast.
All right. I have a question for Heather.
Okay.
Is she there?
I can summon her. Hey, Heather, do you have a sec?
Okay.
Hi, Heather.
Hi, Anthony.
How are you doing?
I am pooped.
You are?
Yes, I'm weeding the lawn.
I've got a question for you about Game of Thrones.
Okay, go for it.
I know that you don't enjoy watching sweaty people on screen. And there were a lot of sweaty people in the show, and how did you navigate that?
So there's two types of sweaty movies. There's the sweaty movie where they're sweating because they have like a ton of makeup on and the lighting is so hot that they look oily and sweaty and very uncomfortable.
Yes.
But when it's through, you're sweating because you're in a battle or climax, it's like they're not caked on with tons of
makeup.
The sweat
has to be believable.
Yeah. I don't like when it's, you can just tell they're suffering under the lights of the movie set.
So what about like Cool Hand Luke? Because there's a lot of sweaty men in that movie.
Yeah, see, that's the sweatiest movie of all time. And it's, they're wearing like so much makeup, and you can tell that there's like a ton of lights in the studio, and the studio is 1,000 degrees. And so they're sweating in scenes they're not even supposed to be sweating in because it's just so hot in there. And then it's just, I start to feel like I can't breathe because I feel sorry for them that they can't, that they're kind of suffocating under the lights. So then I get uncomfortable.
In your view, the Dothraki, the sweat was believable on the Dothraki.
Yeah. And, you know, if they weren't sweating, you would feel like they weren't, you weren't like in the movie, but it wasn't that, it was because there were no, you know, actor rights back then.
Okay. All right. Well, that was my question.
All right.
Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you too. Bye.
There you have it.
I'm glad I asked. All right. Let me ask you this, because I've been dying to ask. So we established it in our first conversation that you had not watched much Game of Thrones, if any, at all.
Yeah, none.
But you kind of had heard a bit about Game of Thrones in pop culture, right?
Yeah, I mean, I understand that there's a Starbucks scene that's important.
Yeah, exactly. So then I guess the question is...
It's hard to do product placement when it's taking place in
it is. It's difficult. Medieval time. It's difficult, but you can do it. You can make it. In 2011, a lot of people were talking about Ned's beheading. Mm-hmm. So, were you surprised that Ned got beheaded? Did you know that he was going to die?
Well, my assumption is everybody dies in Game of Thrones. Like, that's kind of the... I never knew. I didn't engage in conversations, but it seemed like a running theme was like, more people are dying that we're connecting to. Mm. I was a little surprised that it happened that early.
Yeah, but what I'm asking is, were you successfully isolated from fan talk so that you... I didn't know the outcome.
I will say there's probably like maybe one episode that I'm pretty confident won't have the effect that it should or that it did for other people because it was such a talked about thing.
Which is that?
The Red Wedding.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that was a thing. That was a cultural moment. But
right, so I won't have the same reaction.
Sure.
That everybody else did. I don't know a lot of specifics. I just know it's voluminous.
A lot of people die.
So like I said, the expectation that I have is that because of people talking about people dying, that, you know, don't fall in love with anybody. They'll only break your heart, kind of a thing. I was a little surprised to see Drogo and Ned so quickly.
So you were genuinely unaware that Ned was going to die at the end of season one.
Right.
Okay.
Like, as we got to it, I was like, I expected his death because of the show that I was watching, not because I anticipated him because I knew he was going to die.
So here's another interesting development that I think gets underplayed is that when we get to Baelor, they do something with Jaime that makes me start to be really interested in him as a complex character. I think before that he was sort of like, yeah, he's the classic villain.
Right.
I mean, episode one, he pushes a kid out the window, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But his conversations with Rob and Catelyn, for some reason, I'm starting to be invested in him in a way I wasn't before.
Do you think it's partly because of just the Lannister narrative is opening up through Tyrion's discussions and then by getting a little bit more of a glimpse of Tywin, that if you can empathize with Tyrion, then to a certain degree, you almost have to start to allow yourself to understand Jaime.
I think so. I think that they're laying good groundwork for him. There's interesting things about his character that get revealed here. Number one, he's honest about pushing Bran out the window. And Catelyn says, why? And he says, I had hoped the fall would kill him.
Right.
So there's this weird honesty thing that, you know, he's not a snake in the grass in the way that someone else might be. And then she says something about if the gods are just, you'll be in the lowest level of hell or something. And he really calls her out on this and says, which gods are you talking about? Like, there are no gods that are going to, they care about justice. The tree gods aren't going to help you. So what are we even talking about? So he's got this sort of interesting self-awareness and commentary on the social structures around Catelyn and Rob that seem a little bit almost refreshing.
Well, we've seen it with when it comes to like his fighting, right? He didn't want any interruption. He was going to win on his own terms.
Yeah, he's got his own sense of the man he is, and he's not going to. He's very proud of the man he is.
Well, it's almost a detriment to him that he's a Lannister, and it feels like he's trying to carve out this sense of, you know, his identity. What, you know, his identity was set with his last name. Mm-hmm. Yet the perception of him is that, you know, he's a Lannister first and he's Jaime second. And you get that sense of like, so maybe that level of honesty is like, I feel like he doesn't want to believe that anything he's doing or getting away with is because he can get away with it, but because he, you know, by
virtue. Oh, yeah, he wants to earn it.
Right. He's like, hey, if I push your kid out a window, I push your kid out a window. And he doesn't, and he stops short of saying why, like what his motivation for wanting to kill the kid was. But like, so that's an interesting, I thought that was an interesting moment, right? I mean, it's like he's honest to a point. He didn't say because he saw something he shouldn't have seen or whatever. He was, I want to kill him. So there's a moment there where you can see almost a level of honor, kind of. And then, you know, if you start
he's
looking
got
at
his own twisted sense of what, you know, he's in a lot of ways, I think he's classically like Nietzsche's Übermensch.
Right.
Like he views himself as like this artist. He's, you know, the art is swordplay or whatever, but he's almost a god unto himself.
Because what would the perception have been if he had said, I was having sex with my sister, right? I mean, but that's very layered, right? Does he hold that back because he's protecting her honor? Does he hold it back because he feels that that's a bit of a vulgar thing to throw a kid out of a window for? That's where it becomes complex, right? So like he's honest to a point. He sort of protects his family, whether that was his intent or not. I mean, you look at Ned. Ned's in prison and opts to be dishonest to try to protect his family. Jaime takes a different tack. I think that's probably the thing that I enjoy the most about a lot of what's going on is all the different juxtapositions and little callbacks.
So Ned's gone, Drogo's gone, and we have this interesting exchange between Dany and Miri Mazdoor where she comes clean. People are just confessing left and right. This is like a Scooby-Doo episode.
Yeah, it is. It is a lot of confession. And
she basically just says, yeah, well, they shouldn't have burned down my God's temple. That wasn't right.
Yeah, they killed my favorite baker or whatever it was.
You don't kill my baker. You don't cut kill off, my don't, baker.
Don't cut off my scone supply.
So she's an interesting character because I think that over the course of the season, we're really invested in Dany, right? And we're not invested in this woman who's having a bad hair day at all, right?
Right.
She looks like she's having a number of bad hair days concurrently.
Yeah. She's borrowed other people's bad hair.
Yeah, right. We're not invested in her at all. But in retrospect, I have a lot of sympathy for her decision and her rationale. Basically, I mean, she's sort of a trickster, right? She's,
sure.
She says, look, I said I'd preserve his life. Ultimately, I did good because your child was going to be the stallion that mounts the world, and now there's not going to be a conquest. In that moment, do you view her as a villain or do you view her as a savior?
She's just another piece in the Game of Thrones, right? I mean, that's the whole thing, right? I mean, morality and is being blurred. That's what I see with the whole concept of honor. What she's doing would be considered honorable for her legacy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she's not a warrior, but she was able to, in her situation, she could have basically lived as a slave and been compliant. And what does that mean? It just means she's another spoil of war, and maybe she's spared as opposed to murdered. So, but what's the difference? You're not even a footnote in history. But if you are in a position where you're spared, and then you can be like, look, I kind of leveled an army, or at least a future one, for all the people that were left behind and all the people that were either enslaved or murdered, I'm getting my revenge. And so that interesting thing when you pose villain or savior, I don't know that revenge falls into either one of those categories cleanly.
Yeah, that's right. I was interviewing someone else recently who said that in Martin's world, the lines between justice and revenge are almost non-existent. It's not just that they're blurry, that these are category distinctions that just don't work. I'm not sure I quite go in for that, but in this case, you know, certainly she has been able to justify her actions. I think Miri Mazdoor is like, of course. I tricked you. I killed your baby. And it probably saved thousands of lives.
That's right. She ordered the code red and a few good men.
She ordered the code red.
So I have a question for you. Yeah. This became a bit of a discussion topic last night. Does Daenerys know she's not going to get burned up?
I think she knows.
Okay.
What was the argument in your household?
Well, it was just brought up as a question because, you know, my wife took more of your stance, like, yeah, you know, she didn't burn herself with dragon eggs. I'm like, yeah, but we all have like those one days where like, oh, I should have gotten hurt, but I didn't. I mean, that doesn't mean you just step
in. We all have those days where we put our hands into the brazier and we're completely fine.
But I mean, there's a difference between, hey, these dragon eggs didn't leave a mark, and I can walk into fire.
Well, I guess
I'm willing to accept that she knew she wasn't going to burn. She know the eggs was going to hatch.
Okay, here's everything I know. Are you ready?
Buckle up.
Buckle up. There are several hints that were dropped. In the very first scene, she gets into a hot bath, and I don't know if it's in the book or in the show, but it's sort of like, hey, that water's too hot. Don't get in there. And she's fine.
That's right. You know, I think that shows up in the first one.
And then there's the egg scene, which you just mentioned. She shouldn't have been burned. When Viserys gets his egg covered gold, she says he's no dragon. A fire can't kill a dragon.
Gotcha.
So there's something there. At least there's hints that she's learning a little bit more about herself.
Yeah, and then the her baby was described as a dragon, essentially.
That's right. And I think that in addition to that, we know sort of from these other books that Martin has written that in order to birth a dragon, there has to be a human sacrifice. Mm. And she straps Miri Mazdoor to the pyre.
Right, okay.
Suggesting, and she says, I don't want to hear your screams, I just want your life.
Right.
Okay. As if she's sort of intentionally, she's got some sort of intentionality going on. She has this sort of hold my beer moment where she looks at Jorah right before she walks onto the pyre.
Right.
She looks at him and he's like, I'm not going to watch you climb onto that fire and burn. And she's like, is that what you fear? And she just looks at him with utter confidence. And she doesn't say, hold my beer, but that's what she means.
Yeah, no doubt.
And then she gets onto the pyre. So I think, she's trying to commit suicide.
I agree with that. My question was just like, was this a, let's find out. Or was it like, I know what's about to happen?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe here's how I think it works, and I'm willing to take the risk.
Right, right. Yeah, because at this point, why not? I have enough anecdotal evidence to suggest. I got dragon.
So you got your dragons, man. The dragon showed up.
After all of this, and I'm all about political intrigue, they don't end it with Ned's head, which would have been probably more along the, ooh, this guy likes political intrigue, let's chop off Ned's head. It's like, no, nope, we're going to end with dragons. Let's see if he's still in.
So the series that Martin wrote is called A Song of Ice and Fire. And that last episode, you see Jon and the Night's Watch go north.
Right.
So they're going into the ice.
Yeah.
Presumably to meet the ice monsters, right?
Sure.
And which we meet in the very first scene.
Exactly. I've made that comment. I'm like, here we go, right? I mean, we saw a glimpse of him so long ago, it seems, that it's surprising that, you know.
So we're going to get more ice monsters, and we're going to get more dragons. And unfortunately, season two, we're also going to get a lot more Joffrey.
Oh, boy. This is going to really test my loyalties.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into season two.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
For this week's Birds Eye View, I want to talk about Tywin's kids, all the kiddos sitting around the table at Winterfell talking about poor Bran and what befell Bran, how Bran befell himself, I don't know. Tywin's kids and how they each relate to the problem of power. And I want to emphasize the phrase problem of power. I think that it's tempting to think of power as an absolute asset in the Game of Thrones, but I think that Martin's world is a bit more nuanced than this. I think power is necessary. Power is important. When it's used judiciously, it can serve the common good, but it's just as likely to ruin your life. Let's not forget that the Iron Throne is actually made from ruined swords. It is a metaphor. Whatever else it is, the Iron Throne is a metaphor. It's just as dangerous to be king in Martin's world as it is to be a farmer. And it might be more dangerous to be a king in Martin's world. So, interestingly, none of Tywin's kids become king. Although as queen, Kingsguard, and hand of the king, each one of these kids orbits the gravity of the Iron Throne in various ways. Tywin's kids are creatures that live in close proximity to power. And as such, they live with the problems of power. But Cersei, Jaime, and Tyrion each present differently. I have a sense that both Jaime and Tyrion sort of hate being Lannisters, for all of the obvious reasons. But both are resolved to play the hand they've been dealt. Cersei mostly hates, or appears to hate, being married to Robert. This is sort of a unique powerlessness in the story, known only by women from very powerful families. Cersei, of course, wouldn't be married to Robert if not for Tywin's political agenda. Otherwise, I think Cersei embraces Tywin's pursuit of legacy in ways that the boys don't. And I wonder what sort of juggernaut Cersei and Tywin might have created if she was queen while her father was hand, and if Tywin actually took that supporting role seriously.
Tyrion and Cersei actually have a lot in common, though they would probably be loath to admit it. Both have been undermined by their father and both carry the weight of his disapproval. But Tyrion is especially vexed. Tyrion knows that he literally cannot survive for very long outside of the Lannister fold. So even though he hates being a Lannister, he needs the power it affords him on a fundamental level. And let's be honest, he probably likes lording it over people from time to time. It's helpful to him. He can win arguments that way. He likes being wealthy. He likes the things that wealth brings. So he hates and needs to be a Lannister. Jaime is the one kid who probably could have been king if he wanted it. But Jaime is so committed to the art of swordplay that running the kingdom sounds a bit boring to him. In a sense, he's attracted to a pure sort of power, and I'm putting pure here in scare quotes. It could be that contests on the battlefield have less to do with one's family name, and that is maybe attractive to Jaime. It's the one place where Jaime doesn't have to live in his father's shadow or play second fiddle to Cersei or Robert. Jaime would probably prefer to be a knight with a different family name. At the same time, he benefits from all sorts of power and remains almost oblivious to it. So while Tywin's kids live in proximity to power and each themselves are powerful in a number of ways, they don't have the kind of power that Tywin himself has. Interestingly enough, one other member of the Lannister clan who's sitting at the table with Tywin's kids does indeed become king, and that is Tommen. Tommen's relationship to power is simply that he doesn't know what to do with it. He's simply there to be pushed around. And one might say that that is the most immoral or unethical approach to power, to simply have no backbone at all and let other more powerful people push you around. But that is somewhat debatable. So let me pose this question to you, book@baldmove.com. Which of these approaches to power is the most ethical? Which is the least ethical? We have Tommen, who just gets pushed around, who really doesn't know what to do with the power. We've got Tyrion, who knows that it's kind of icky, but he kind of needs it, kind of likes it on some level. We've got Jaime, who's totally shrugs it off, doesn't take the throne when he has an opportunity to do it. He would prefer not to have anything to do with it, but he benefits from it a great deal anyway. Or Cersei, who desperately wants power and might be able to do a lot with it, but probably selfishly, probably being sort of Tywin Jr. in that regard. Which of these characters takes the most ethical approach to the dirty little problem of power? Or maybe I frame this incorrectly or unhelpfully, and you'd like to help me reframe it. I'd love to hear from you. book@baldmove.com. Again, my gratitude to you. If you've listened all the way to the end, you've made this a whole lot of fun for me.
Next time on Electric Boogaloo.
You know, how many people go into work and think, all right, these are all my enemies, and I need to get them before they get me. It's just not how people, normal people, live their lives.
Well, I feel like that was a shot at me.